Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Today we have the third part, the last part of Buried Alive, Torture in America. But first we have a brief update about the case of Lynn Stewart. As you know, there was the resentencing and the horrendous decision by Judge Codal to resentence Lynn to 10 years, 120 months.
Ralph is going to give a five-minute presentation today, and then we will pick it up with all the documents in hand of this miserable judge's ruling and how we proceed, brothers and sisters. Ralph.
Thank you, Ralph. Just a brief statement on Lynn Stewart's sentencing. It's perjury. Thy name is the United States government. The president-elect begins lying when announcing candidacy, only to renege on every promise. War, health care, Social Security, economy, etc. To excuse the president, it is quoted, he must perjure him or herself to become president. It is an understood and unstated American way. Accepted perjury. When taking the oath of office, the president swears to uphold the Constitution and then proceeds to support the dismantling of the Constitution, the Patriot Act. Hypocritical perjury. In office, the president employs signing. That is, after signing a bill, signing a statement saying he will not abide by the bill. Premeditated perjury. There's more perjury gone on in this administration in these few years than all of the Bush administration. When Lynn Stewart was attacked by the government for making a press release on the Sheikh's behalf, it was revealed that other attorneys had made press releases before she did. The New York federal prosecutor said they didn't know about them. The national federal prosecutor said other lawyers should be charged and arrested. The Second Circuit of Appeals said it was selective prosecution, but they would not deal with it. And that Lynn Stewart should be further prosecuted or given a harsher sentence. Prosecutorial perjury. Is there anyone on the planet who does not know that the Landmarks case was hatched and planned for by the U.S. government with an Egyptian operative named Emad Salem? Is there anyone on this planet who does not know that the FBI directed every step of the plot by promising unemployed, hapless hangers-on money to be involved in this so-called plot? It was staged, financed, and filmed by the undercover operative Emad Salem with constant oversight by the FBI. They desired to discredit the blind sheikh. The FBI charged the blind sheikh for not reporting the FBI operative to the FBI. The blind sheikh merely said, I don't think this would be good for Islam, and no, pick another target, never acquiescing to a plan of Emad Salem. National security perjury. The judge first rejected this case against Lynn Stewart as being vague. The judge reversed himself and allowed the case to proceed. The judge allowed Osama bin Laden in the case while saying it had only to do with the state of mind of a third defendant. He allowed the massacre of Luxor in the case, I guess for dramatic effect, although having nothing to do with the case. Finally, I want to talk about the perjury on the part of the so-called progressive people who leap to embrace any and every petty accusation made about Lynn Stewart. She is arrogant. She would like to think she would defend and support the First Amendment speech. She would like to think that she would defend the right for people to have attorney. She is not remorseful. And have people forgotten? Have we forgotten bravery, courage, Patrick Henry, John Brown, Harriet Tubman, Fannie Lou Hamer? Have we forgotten the principles of Lynn Stewart, the principles that she stood by for 50 years? Have we forgotten who we claim to be, progressive people? Whose side are we on, brothers and sisters? Let us remember John Paul Jones. We have not yet begun to fight. Join us, join Lynn, join the struggle, the view of America that is inclusive, and the view that we think America should have and should become. Thank you.
You were fantastic, Ralph. We'll be together next week with a full hour, and we're going to document the crimes against Lynn Stewart and the cowardly acquiescence of those who profess to be her supporters.
Right on. Thank you, Ralph.
Thanks, Ralph.
Children and teens forced to spend hours on their knees with their hands bound behind their backs, shot at point-blank range with a foam baton gun, maced regularly and strapped into four-point restraint chairs, forced to wear a spit mask for a month or more, overdosed with psychotropic and other drugs, isolated for months on end in a 6x8 room, the walls covered with dried mucus, blood, and feces for 23 hours a day, with only 1 hour reprieve in a cage. These conditions, and even worse, were found to be typical of California's 11 youth facilities. Today, on Taking Aim, Part 3 of Buried Alive, Torture in America. Ralph?
Maya, we have discussed the systematic use of weapons and instruments of torture, from the stun gun to the devil's chair with 50,000 volts of electricity at random and at whim and at will, charged into bound and helpless and shackled prisoners. We've discussed the mere fact of hepatitis C as a result of the 87% use of shackles on prisoners, because the walls and the floors are covered with feces and urine and blood, and infection is the paradigm. It's the rule. This is the daily reality of prison in the United States, a torture machine. But it has a particular dimension that we only began to touch on at the end of Part 2, and that is the torture of children.
The Prison Law Office in California, right outside the walls of San Quentin, notorious for its death row, has for over 20 years represented individual prisoners in their civil cases concerning conditions of confinement. It is engaged in class action and other impact litigation, and is responsible for improvements and change in the lives of individual prisoners and in the conditions in the prisons themselves. Recently, they focused on the conditions for youth in California, the 6,000 youth from the ages of 12 to 25 incarcerated in the 11 youth facilities. Construction of these facilities hasn't been done in over a generation, with many of the prisons over 40 years old, with broken windows and decaying conditions, overcrowded, and now holding over 6,000 youth. If you look at this incredible complaint and also the reports that were completed by the state at the request of the Attorney General and also by the federal government, you will see conditions that hark back to medieval times. And these are conditions that are imposed upon children and teenagers. Particularly, as I mentioned, the use of cages. In California, within the institutions, there are more than 70 cages. And these are cages in which children are confined for classroom use, psychological counseling, and also for exercise. Rehabilitation cannot succeed, according to the Prison Law Office, in a cage when wards live in constant fear of sexual and physical violence from both the CYA, that's the California Youth Authority, staff, and the other youth incarcerated in these facilities. Treatment is undermined when there is a forced administration of psychotropic medication, and it's used as a tool to control behavior. And it's impossible when psychologists and psychiatrists are not available to the vast majority of the youth. In fact, it was found that the psychologists and the psychiatrists are not even trained to handle youth, and many of them do not have the appropriate licenses and certificates. These are severe, unconstitutional, and illegal problems that plague the California Youth Authority. And what the Prison Law Office noted, that these are not new, nor are they secret. In fact, these conditions have been exposed by the prison authorities themselves, by the federal government, by the state attorney general's office, and by many class action and other individual lawsuits. The prison law office holds Jerry Harper, the director of the California Youth Authority, brought in to revamp the entire youth authority. They find him responsible for the conditions, the terrible, inhumane, discriminatory, and punitive conditions that exist throughout the CYA. Ralph?
Maya, this has been a series that we've dedicated to Bonnie Kerness of the American Friends Service Committee and to Tafawa Balogun, a prisoner who we've defended and been involved with now for over 10 years. Tafawa, who at the age of 15 went into this prison system. Tafawa, by the way, wouldn't go to classes because he was required to be in a cage of the size they use in a kennel for dogs.
And this was in New Jersey, so people who report that cages are used only in California are not aware of the use of cages in states such as New Jersey.
And let it be mentioned as well that Tafawa spent over 10 years in solitary confinement, locked down 23 and a half hours a day. Without contact with other people, under constant torment. We've described the supermax and the special housing units and the systematic and deliberated torture of people through prolonged isolation that drives people insane. But here is Bonnie Kerness in No Child Left Behind. Many of the prisoners and family members with whom we work are aware that the youngsters of color are labeled worthless to an economy that generates $60,000 a year when they are trapped in a criminal justice system. The expansion of prisons, parole, probation, court, and police systems has resulted in a huge bureaucracy, which has been a boon to everyone from architects, plumbers, and electricians to food and medical vendors, with one thing in common, a paycheck earned because this country insists on keeping its citizens in cages and human warehouses. The criminalization of poverty, Bonnie writes, is a business, and we've replaced a social safety net and a caring educational system with a dragnet. And she goes on to describe how the daily experience of the young and of the vulnerable is almost beyond the ability to listen. We were unprepared for the young people's reactions as they spoke. Many cried, many expressed such fear of retaliation that they would not allow us to use their names. And she quotes the series of interviews. They mace the boys. They jump on their back and they mace you. They hit you with big sticks. They use pepper spray. They hit me with these long black sticks. I have the marks on my back. I kept saying, my eyes, my eyes, my eyes. You can't see anything. You don't know who's hitting you. I was 12 when I went to the youth house. They pepper spray this girl. They beat up a boy. They threw the boy in the hole, took all his clothes from him. He had to sleep naked. It was freezing in there. He was screaming. They used pepper spray on this girl. They sprayed her directly in the mouth. She couldn't breathe. We kept telling them she had asthma. They would not listen. The male guards be having sex with the females routinely. Guards bring in weed and cigarettes for the kids. I remember him bringing a girl he was having sex with some cigarettes. I left out of there with a nasty rash. I had just turned 12. They locked the younger kids in their room and they can't go to rec. Before I left, there was a boy who was 11 who they abused. Then they made him stay in the cell all day and he cried all the time. I was 14 when I went in. Another youth describes, they have what they call the MCU, and it's like the hole in a regular prison. No light, no sound, total darkness. Kids are put in there. If you refuse, they come and they get you. You don't see anybody. They bring food to you. They turn off the toilets at 9 so you can't go. You get a shower once a week. The cops are racist, even the black ones. They stop 9 and 10-year-olds. They throw them in a car and handcuff them. They take them to a different location, and then they disappear. They actually put drugs on you. They have a new charge now. It's called wandering. We get charged for wandering. And the litany goes on. This is the singling out, the identification of the vulnerable young, overwhelmingly black and Latino, invariably impoverished and in the sectors of our inner cities that are most oppressed and most exploited. This is class war. This is race war. This is a war of destruction waged against our youth, our most vulnerable.
It's important to note, as you mentioned, Ralph, that it costs in California and also, as Bonnie found in New Jersey and in other places throughout the country, $60,000 per year to incarcerate a youth. in these penitentiary systems, the youth authorities. $60,000 per year, much more than it costs to go to Andover, Exeter, Phillips Academy, the best boarding schools throughout the country. We have youths from the ages of 12 to 25. When they're 18, they can be transferred in California to a prison. But in many states throughout the United States, you find children as young as 14 in the same prisons as adults. In the youth authority, the average age is 19, and 95% of the youth in the California Youth Authority, of which we're going to focus on particularly today, because of the recent exposés that came out this month, actually, with the five reports that were prepared by the Special State Office in reaction to the prison law office class action suit.
And they were part of a detailed series by Associated Press writer Jim Wasserman and his colleagues.
When the American Friends Service Committee did its report on children, they used mentors, young people who had been through similar experiences, to talk to the youth. But in California, Dr. Barry Kressberg prepared the most comprehensive of the reports, and it's called General Corrections Review of the California Youth Authority, and he is the president of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency and has written four books on juvenile justice. And in preparation, he interviewed 100 youths in the California Youth Authority in various facilities throughout California. He found, when he talked about excessive use of force by prison guards, is he found that they didn't really talk about it. And he noted that it is common that county staff use chemical and physical restraints in the institutions, so that the YA, that's the youth authority wards, may have perceived their treatment by staff as a continuation of the expected treatment of young inmates in the California juvenile justice institutions. Furthermore, these people have endured long personal histories of violence directed at them by family members, gang peers, and other law enforcement personnel. Also, he found that youth are apprehensive to talk. Throughout the California system, when anyone had a grievance, they were disciplined for their grievance, or the grievances were lost, or the grievances were never dealt with, or they were dealt with beyond the one-year statutory limitation for administrative recourse against the staff. To go back to the lawsuit, the prison law office notes, it's common practice for the CYA staff and or guards to slam a ward down, pull his arms behind his back, force a knee in his back, and use excessive amounts of mace or other chemical agents even after the ward is restrained.
A ward is a youth prisoner, by the way.
Right. A ward of the state. The youth prisoners also have had their heads slammed against walls and rails, have been beaten and burned by tear gas canisters and maced for no reason. For example, a youth was repeatedly sprayed with chemical agents for declining to undergo a strip search after being placed in a holding room. Another was knocked unconscious and shot in the head. Another was handcuffed face down and repeatedly struck in the head. Rape, sexual assault, and sexual harassment are common within the facilities, and some youths are housed in the same living facilities as others who have previously raped or sexually assaulted them. And staff are indifferent to the youth's request for protection from those who have assaulted
them.
And
with a very particular reason, because the most ubiquitous source of sexual abuse and of rape is from the staff themselves. The staff are notorious for targeting women and vulnerable children. It is routinized practice in the American prison system and documented in California.
The youth who are on lockup, the 23 hours a day in lockup for months on end, they're often fed only blender meals, which are entire meals, a sandwich, a vegetable, and milk, that have been put into a blender and liquefied and then fed to them through a straw through the cell door. no personal contact. And other times, they have inadequate rations or dangerously undercooked food, which cause the adolescents and the young adults to lose significant amounts of weight and to get ill. And when they are ill, it is very difficult for them to see medical staff. Ralph?
Another facet of the treatment of prisoners, and it's particular to the youth but not confined to them, is the ubiquitous use of psychotropic drugs and of medications that have long since expired. And the documentation is of medications being used 11 times the prescribed dosage. These are not treatments for anything. They are weapons of torment. They are psychological and mental assaults through the use of chemistry and of medications that have toxic effects in themselves. And the result is a neurological breakdown, spasms and tremors that are uncontrollable. These are not medical treatments, although they parade under the guise as such. These are part of the arsenal of torment and of assault. The article in the San Francisco Chronicle on February 3rd, Facty for Prisons, a state report on the systemic violence, kids kept in cages, as you have cited, Maya, and it indeed makes reference to the 10 assaults a day, which are on the average against youth, unprecedented in juvenile corrections across the nation, mental health treatment inadequate because there is no such thing. The wards are given as 8 different psychotropic medications without justification, and the vast majority of youths, the San Francisco Chronicle reports, are made far worse, according to Eric Troopin and Raymond Patterson from University of Washington, professors who have evaluated what passes for mental health care programs in correctional settings across the country. In fact, this has little to do with treatment. It has everything to do with assault through medication.
Ralph, let's look at the lockup, because the lockup is overused for punitive reasons. If youths are having a problem, instead of trying to find out what that problem is, immediately they are maced, they are put into restraints, and they are put into lockups. And the youths live in a regime, it's called 23-1, which forces them to stay inside their cells for 23 hours of the day and provides only 1 hour of program time outside the cell. By legislation in California, youths are supposed to have 4 hours of schooling. If you're in the youth authority, you're supposed to go to high school, and also you're supposed to accumulate a GED. And even in some facilities, you have the ability to get college credit. But if you're in 23-1, you only have 1 hour of program outside your cell, and that takes place in a cage, which is called a special or secure program area, or SPA. Then when the wards are on lockup, they must attend, as I mentioned before, the educational counseling sessions in this cage or through a small slot in the cell door. They are often not permitted any access to reading material, television, or radio, or to have contact with their families. Often their telephone calls are curtailed. In Barry Kreisberg's report, he noted that 80 of the youths in lockup units that had been interviewed by the federal government had complained that they were not even receiving their legally required services. 36 said they didn't receive their 1 hour out of their rooms, especially on weekends. 90% claimed they didn't even get religious counseling, which is mandated by law. And a third mentioned that they hadn't had their required phone calls. 40% didn't even have regular visits from a treatment team after they were in temporary detention, which is supposed to be short-term detention. Now, each of these youths is supposed to have a treatment plan. Most of the youths in the California Youth Authority are diagnosed with substance abuse when they enter the facility, and yet there really isn't any means for drug treatment programs in the facilities themselves or therapy.
Well, that leads us to a larger discussion, which we'll come to a bit later, namely that as far as drugs are concerned, this is a social policy of flooding the most impoverished areas of our cities with drugs that are not just monitored but controlled by the nominal enforcement agencies, from the local police to the Drug Enforcement Agency to the FBI and the Central Intelligence Agency itself. These are, in fact, weapons against the poor. This is the criminalization of poverty and the use of drugs to control a population and to provide the fodder for the prison system. This is the article again by Jim Wasserman on February 2nd in the Chronicle, which makes reference to the Kreisberg Report, California Youth Lockup, a Disaster Area. And he states that the California Youth Authority provides abusive treatment for people with mental health problems. The Chronicle established that there is extensive use of mace, the absence of medical attention, and that state-funded reports completed last summer established that there are 4,600 youth at 11 institutions that are subject to such abuse that there is, quote, an intense climate of fear. It is abundantly clear from the range of data that the youth authority is a most dangerous place, that no one feels safe in its facilities. In 2002, in the six institutions that Kreisberg visited, he tallied 4,000 individual assaults and 1,000 incidents of sexual assault, this on the part of staff. These levels are unprecedented. In the first 4 months at the Herman G. Stark Youth Correctional Facility in Chino, California, the staff used what are called, quote, chemical restraints 535 documented times, physical restraints, which means putting them in these devil's chairs, and four-point restraints 109 times, and mechanical restraints 236 times. This is what is on record. It has nothing to do with the unofficial and constant use of these abusive methods, which, of course, they don't bother to record in any documentable fashion.
The state report of the findings of the mental health and the substance abuse treatment services to youth in the California Youth Authority facilities, which was completed in December of 2003, states that they go through a diagnostic evaluation with all the youths who enter the facilities. And they found that 85% of the California Youth Authority population have substance abuse problems, and 65% have what they consider mental health problems. Yet there is no treatment. Treatment, when it is given, is psychotropic medications. And the report itself noticed that, quote, there are a number of instances of polypharmacy, with youth receiving 3 to 8 different psychotropic medications without adequate justification in the record. Now, remember, this is the state report itself. This is the report that was done by the state because of this class action suit. And that is noting that youths are receiving 3 to 8 different psychotropic medications without adequate justification, and that they also observed that nighttime medications were not available in some facilities. It's interesting to look at the impact of all these medications. They note and they emphasize that youths metabolize medication at a faster rate than adults, thus exacerbating the potential for the benefits of medications to be mitigated, promoting deteriorations in mental status when you don't give them the nighttime medications. Ralph?
The chemical cocktail here, yep, I have to emphasize, has little to do with health treatment. It has everything to do with psychic war upon the victim, and notably upon the young.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Ralph?
The American Friends Service Committee, as Bonnie Kerness describes in her report on November 1st, 2003, has discerned, quote, a crisis that has allowed children to be demonized. It is a crisis that has legitimized torture, isolation, and the abuse of power. It is a crisis that extends far beyond the prisons themselves. It is a crisis of our schools and our judicial system. It is a crisis that every day obliges children to face a system that doesn't care or understand that children going to bed hungry are experiencing violence, that wealth concentrated in the hands of the few at the expense of the many is violence, that the denial of dignity based on class and race is sustained violence, that we are violating the human rights of children and we are demonizing children from cradle to the grave based on racial and class criteria. The targets are the poor. The targets are the children of color. And the report is definitive in assigning this entire system not to the vagaries of careless guards or the absence of oversight or the pressures of overcrowding, which are the consequence of demonizing and incarcerating the youth and the poor on a mass basis. It is a crisis that derives from the class war and race war that is waged against a victim population by design and for a social end.
Ralph, it's important to look at what the state itself says in its reports, because this is an understatement, and yet even in its understatement, it is talking about the most heinous of conditions. For instance, when they talk about medication, they say it's a major concern. Now, for them to say it's a major concern reveals that this is torture. It's a torturous practice, which they describe if you look at the details. For instance, denial of medical treatment when children have fractures or if they require surgery that must take place outside the prison, and this is all neglected. It says medication provided to youths who are cuffed and kneeling continues to be, quote, a dangerous practice. And practices such as 23 hours of seclusion and liberal use of shackles and cuffs that recur in restrictive housing units exacerbate, not rehabilitate, mental health problems. Like you say, they are putting these children in jeopardy. And as the prison law office states unequivocally, they are creating a factory to turn people into the evolving prison system. There's much more to say about the youths, but we also want to cover today the situation in the prisons themselves concerning the use of slave labor. And now, Ralph, on to the issue of slave labor.
Well, Maya, the Angel Fire website, which is a mine of documentation about the prison industrial complex and the what is in essence a plantation and slave system, has the following observation. Prisons are now abundantly run by private companies that have the majority of the prisoners in the United States under their control. The major computer companies are Microsoft, Dell, IBM, Compaq, Motorola, Texas Instruments, Nortel, Lucent Technologies, AT&T Wireless, Bay Networks, 3Com, Intel, Northern Telecom, Digital Switch, New Bridge Networks, to cite only the most prominent. Now, what we are describing here is the very heart of corporate capital in the United States, for which the prisons are an ocean of supply for slave labor. The wages of the labor, the report continues, makes the use of this labor extraordinarily attractive for all types of business. The Wackenhut Corporation has a huge portion of private-run portion of the prison market, and the documentation pertaining to the ubiquitous use of labor in prisons by the heart of American corporate production is pervasive.
Ralph, an article called "The Use of Prison Labor in the Computer Market" notes that Exmark, E-X-M-A-R-K, packages and shrinks wraps many products for Microsoft. Many Microsoft products are packaged and shrink wrapped by prisoners at Washington State's Twin Rivers Correction Center, TRCC, according to Dan Penz, who's co-editor of the Prison Legal News and a prisoner at TRCC. Penz tells NewsBytes, which then reported it on AngelFire.com, that Exmarks, which is a company specializing in product packaging and located in Monroe, Washington, and is a subsidiary of PAC Services, used the services of 90 prisoners at TRCC to package 50,000 units of Windows 95 demo disks and direct mail promotional packets. And then they also package tens of thousands of units of Microsoft Office, other software, and hundreds of thousands of Microsoft mice. Xmarks pays its prisoners the minimum wage of $4.90 an hour in Washington, but the figure is misleading. After deductions by the prisoner, prisoners see a spendable wage of $1.80 to $2.80 per hour. But the law then authorizes up to 80% of the prisoner's wages to be deducted, meaning that they actually take home less than $1 an hour. That's actually high. In many institutions, it comes down to 20 cents an hour.
About 21 cents an hour is what they are paying prisoners in these slave wage circumstances. And one has to keep in mind when you talk about the 21 cents an hour that prisoners are then obliged to forfeit a substantial portion of their munificent pay to the institution itself.
And also to pay for their hygiene items like toothpaste, soap, and extra toilet paper, and also to buy all their other needs, such as their clothing.
And when they buy from the prison by force or by obligation, there's a 30% surcharge on top of it all for the privilege of buying from the prison institution itself.
For the so-called victim restitution fund. Now, Xmark, Ralph, which packages for Microsoft, also packages for other companies using prison labor, such as JanSport, Starbucks, U.S. West, and Costco. And this was reported in 1997. Ralph?
Look for that prison label is the title of the article by Julie Light in The Progressive in June 2000. The assembly lines at CMT Blues look like those at any other U.S. garment factory. Workers hunch over industrial sewing machines, intently stitching T-shirts. But unlike most garment workers, however all of these are made, there's an even bigger difference because armed guards patrol the shop floor. CMT Blues is housed at Maximum Security, Richard J. Donovan State Correctional Facility outside of San Diego, California. It is part of California's growing joint venture programs that links companies to all state prisons. Workers are sewing T-shirts for Mecca, Seattle Cotton Works, Lee Jeans, No Fear, Trinidad Tees, and many other U.S. companies. The highly prized jobs pay far less than minimum wage, but less than half of the small amounts they receive find their way into inmates' pockets. The rest is siphoned off to the state, nominally for the cost of incarceration. The inmates, their families, and their dependents receive vanishingly little. The California Department of Corrections and CMT Blues owner Pierre Simon says they are providing inmates with job skills and a work ethic. But inmates who worked for CMT Blues state Sliman and the Department of Corrections are operating a slave labor sweatshop behind bars. What's more, the inmates state prison officials retaliate against them when they blew the whistle on what they claim was corruption at the plant. The prisoners state they were forced to replace made in Honduras labels with made in USA tags to defraud consumers. And they were not paid minimum wages at all or paid on time or paid at all for their first months of work. CMT Blues is the tip of the iceberg.
Ralph, in 1990, there was a ballot initiative. California has an initiative process where the people of California, as well as the legislature, can change the Constitution and create laws. In 1990, there was a ballot initiative that created the Joint Venture Program, and CMT Blues is operating under that Joint Venture Program with the California Department of Contracts, and CMT Blues happens to be the largest contractor in this Joint Venture Program. There's a benefit for corporations to operate in California prisons. Not only do they pay minimum wage, they get a 10% tax break. 10% corporate tax break, and often the prisoners provide the very factories and the construction for the factories. In Oregon, there was also a ballot measure, 49, in 1997, and that mandated inmates to work. In other words, inmates in Oregon must work, and Oregon uses the money to pay for the incarceration. And again, with sweatshop labor, we have there the manufacture of Prison Blues brand, and it was established by Inside Oregon Enterprises. It's a division of the Oregon Department of Corrections. It manufactures jeans, yard coats, and work shirts made by and for the Oregon inmates, but they are distributed throughout the world, and they have a website. You can go to Prison Blues, and you will see they manufacture over 200,000 garments, and they could produce 500,000 for the private sector as well as for Oregon. Again, is looking for the label. Here you have the label of Prison Blues.
Well, Maya, Prison Blues story is endemic. The Brutal Society, Prison Labor on the Rise in the United States by Alan White and Jamie Baker, May 8, 2000. U.S. trade union officials repeatedly denounced China for its use of sweatshop slave and prison labor, and I might add, rightfully so. Indeed, it is ubiquitous that not only are slave labor conditions cultivated in the bureaucracy-run China of today, but actually there is an ample documentation that there is a systematic murder of the most impoverished of the peasants who come into these slave labor conditions when they attempt to leave them. But with respect to prison labor on the rise in the United States, the willingness of the AFL-CIO to speak about the conditions of labor in China is not matched by their response to those in the United States. 80,000 inmates in the United States were documented as earning 21 cents an hour. The U.S. government program Federal Prison Industries, which directly employs 21,000 inmates, has been supervising the forced labor for such products as clothing, file cabinets, electronic equipment, and military equipment, which are sold to federal agencies and private companies. Indeed, much of the military supplies and hardware that are deployed and used for the sending of troops to do imperial tasks overseas are made by prisoners who are being paid less than 21 cents an hour. In addition, in the last 20 years, 30 states have passed laws requiring the use of convict labor by commercial enterprises. The program is now extended to 36 states. The article continues. Prisoners are now manufacturing everything from blue jeans to auto parts to electronics and furniture. Honda, which is paying people 21 cents an hour, is paying them for doing the same work that an auto worker would get paid $20 to $30 an hour to do the same. Konica uses prisoners to repair copiers for under 50 cents an hour. Toys R Us, Microsoft, clothing in California and Oregon, competing successfully now with apparel made in Latin America and Asia under sweatshop conditions. Inmates employed in a wide variety of service jobs. TWA used prisoners to handle all reservations. AT&T, prison labor for telemarketing. In Oregon, prisoners do all the data entry and record keeping in the Secretary of State's Corporation Division. The jobs include desktop publishing, digital mapping, computer-aided design works. Prisoners who refuse to work under these conditions are labeled uncooperative and lose their good time and are put in permanent isolation. They are deprived of privileges such as library access and recreation. Prisoners at California's Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility were placed in solitary confinement after a local television station broadcast their complaints about working for CMT, the T-shirt manufacturer, requiring them to put in 60 days of nonstop work as unpaid training. The growth of prison labor has led to the destruction of other workers' jobs. An example. Lockhart Technologies closed its plant in Austin, Texas, dismissing its workers so it could open shop in the state prison in Lockhart. The prisoners assemble circuit boards for IBM, Compaq, and Dell. Lockhart is not required to pay for health or any benefits. The company pays the prison the federal minimum wage for each laborer. The inmates get less than 20% of that on the record. And in practice, after deductions, it comes to pennies an hour.
Ralph, you were talking about the 21, 22 cents an hour. And actually, the federal government has Unicor, and Unicor doesn't stand for anything, but it is the trade name of the Federal Prison Industries. It's either called Unicor or FPI, and they're very proud of their website, Unicor, UNICOR.gov. And on it, they talk about an employment goal of 25% of federal prisoners and their inmate pay rate of 23 cents to $1.15, with 111 factories at 71 locations. This is a billion-dollar industry, the federal prison industry, and they manufacture for the federal government, as you say, for the Defense Department. They're very proud. They even mentioned the Defense Department giving them an award for their production. And you can see the varied list of what they manufacture, from law enforcement materials to draperies and curtains to office furniture, office products, electronics, including electronic recycling, that very hazardous work, recycling computer parts and other electronics, dorm furniture, everything. The idea of prisoners just making your license plates is far gone. The prisoners manufacture every item that you can imagine, as well as doing stocking. That's what they were doing for Toys R Us in Wisconsin, is that they were taking them to the Toys R Us stores at night, and the prisoners were being used to stock the shelves. I want to refer to some of the history of prison labor and slavery. And if you look at the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, you will notice that it makes an exception. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So there we have the exception for the conditions of slavery and involuntary servitude if you've been convicted of a crime. In an article, Prison Labor, Slavery, and Capitalism in Historical Perspective by Stephen Hartnett, which is available at www.noprisons.org, he goes through some of the history of the use of prison or slave labor. Frankfort, Kentucky, 1825. Joel Scott paid $1,000 for control of Kentucky's prison labor to build roads and canals, facilitating the settler traffic westward into the Indian lands. This was not the first use of indentured or prison labor, because the actual establishment of the so-called New World was done with the use of British, Scottish, Irish, French, German, and Dutch convicts who were sold into indentured servitude. As he notes, selling so-called criminals to the companies exploring the Americas lowered the cost of maintaining European prisons and enabled the traditional elite to rid themselves of their potential political radicals and provided the cheap labor necessary for the first wave of colonization. You can read more about this in two books that he cites, Peter Lindbaugh's The London Hanged and A.R.
Erkerchy's Bound for America.
Bound for America. Then, after winning the contract in 1825, Joel Scott set up his own private 250-cell prison to house his new so-called workers, his slaves. In a similar deal in 1844, Louisiana leased the labor of prisoners in its Baton Rouge State Penitentiary to private contractors, and California's San Quentin has a very interesting link, something new for us. It's in 1852, J.M. Estill and M.G. Vallejo, and Vallejo is the man for whom the city of Vallejo, where we live, was named, they swapped land that was to become the site of the first state capital for the management of California's prison laborers. Ralph?
Yes, well, actually, as the Harnett article makes clear, quote, there is a strong, intimate, historical relationship between the need for policing the working classes, fueling the military, and the economic needs of the capitalist class, greasing the wheels of imperialism with indentured servants and outright slavery. The examples that you've cited, Maya, are part not of random events, but of a continuity, the relationship between the exploitation of the poor, the criminalization of poverty, and a slave plantation system that has been the weapon with which working people in incarceration and out of incarceration are beaten down. In fact, the three antebellum examples were illustrative of pre-Civil War labor arrangements, but the institution of slavery in the South and the migration of poor Europeans of America in the North provided capitalism with labor at rock-bottom prices and left prison labor as a resource for adventurous capitalists. Prison labor became a significant part of modern capitalism during Reconstruction because the Civil War had provided the conditions for replacing slave labor with wage labor. The United States then undertook to build prisons on a large scale, to lease the labor of prisoners, and many of them ex-slaves, to labor-hungry capitalists, quote, burdened with heavy taxes to meet the expenses of rebuilding an economy and committed to the traditional notion that convicts should by their labor reimburse the government and create additional revenue, the master class, drawing on its experience with penitentiary leases, introduced a system of penal servitude that would make public slaves of blacks and poor and friendless whites, wrote J.T. Sellin, at the time in Slavery and the Penal System.
Ralph Hartnett refers to five kinds of partners between the state and the industrial complex. Those who make the equipment, the stun guns, the pepper spray, the surveillance equipment, and other disciplinary technology such as AdTech, American Detention, and Space Master Enterprises. You have those who build the prisons, the construction industry. You have those that supply the prisons, such as Campbell's Soup or Zosbo Correctional Services, with food and other services. Another partner is those that gain from the corporations like Prison Blues or CMT that use the manufacturing of the prisons. And then lastly, you have the corporations that run the prisons like Wackenhut that you mentioned or the Correctional Corporation of America. In the few minutes that remain, I want to point out a study that was done in The Atlantic, a three-part series of articles by Eric Schlosser, December 98. In this, he refers to California. Now, California has the largest number of prisoners, 160,000. Only China and the United States as a whole have as many prisoners as California. California, if it were a nation, it would be the third largest, but in the United States, it has the largest number of prisoners. He notes that it's really a revolving door. Half the California prisoners that were released on parole are illiterate, and 85% were substance abusers. Nothing was done to create conditions that would allow the prisoners to survive on the outside. When they're released, they're given $200 and a bus ticket back to the county where they were convicted. Two-thirds of the people return to prison, the so-called recidivists, are actually parole violators. And they are parole violators for a technical violation, such as failing a drug test, or they have a small property or drug crime, which gets them back. He says the prison system is becoming a revolving door for the poor and the illiterate drug abusers. And as Ralph has mentioned over and again, the drugs that are brought into the community by the U.S. government itself. Ralph?
There is a continuity, as I've stated. D.A. Novak reveals in The Wheels of Servitude, Black Forced Labor After Slavery, that the death rate of prisoners leased to the railroad companies between 1877 and 1879 was 45% in South Carolina, 25% in Arkansas, 16% in Mississippi. Conditions in the labor camps of the Texas State Penitentiary so bad that 62 died in 1871 alone in one prison. Linked historically to forced labor, the prisons have cultivated inhumane working conditions. And this is part of a continuity. In an award-winning article in The Spotlight, one of the awards for Project Censored, Political Prisoners as Slave Labor, the prison industrial complex is rapidly becoming an indispensable component of the U.S. economy. And it goes on to state, an increasing percentage of prisoners go to work every morning, but their jobs are inside prison walls and they are paid less than third world rates. And it cites in particularity the indispensable relationship between capitalist exploitation, a deteriorating economy, and the enormous explosion of the prison system, the slave system, the continuity of indentured labor, the basis on which the settlers in this country were brought in servitude, the logic of capitalism as it degenerates across our nation.
The prison industrial complex has been called a fortress economy by the American Friends Service Committee. To illustrate the prison industrial complex's role in the capitalist world, you've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Buried Alive, Torture in America.